About a year ago, I was introduced to True Niagen, a supplement specifically designed to boost a key cellular resource called NAD, short for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. I was impressed with the research, which showed that increased NAD levels can promote cellular repair, maintain healthy mitochondria, and increase energy throughout the trillions of cells in your body. Well, I've been taking True Niagen ever since, and I'll tell you, I am convinced by the science, and I'm excited to welcome them back. Let's get into how True Niagen works. From about age 40 to 60, humans can experience about a 50% decline in NAD, leaving our cells with a shortage of that very valuable energy resource. Additionally, things like immune stress, poor diet, even alcohol can all deplete NAD levels. Research suggests that increased NAD can support cellular defense against these physiological stressors. True Niagen is designed to boost NAD levels and is backed by clinical research and regulatory approvals. While the research is continually evolving, I am impressed by the possibilities surrounding NAD and the research behind True Niagen. I suggest you check out the science and the information for yourself. To learn more about the research, science, and to order your supply of True Niagen supplements, visit drdrew.com/TrueNiagen. Use code Drew at checkout for a special discount on orders of 3 bottles or more. That is my website, drdrew.com/TRUNIAGEN, and use that promo code Drew today. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Don't forget to keep supporting those that support us. Check out all the other stuff at drdrew.com. We're trying to stream there, give everyone Corona updates, and highlight certain charities that are doing a great job out in the midst of all this. Thank you for being here, and thank you for supporting the people that support us. Today, it is my overwhelming privilege to welcome my friend Evie Pompouris. The new book is Becoming Bulletproof. Protect yourself, read people, influence situations, and live fearlessly. Evie, something you've always tried to get me to do.
Hey, Drew, how are you?
I'm great. And tell me, before we get into the book, talk to me about the spy games.
Oh, spy games. So we had a competition series on Bravo where we put contestants, the average citizens, and we wanted to see, do they have what it takes to be a spy? So we had 10 contestants, and they were all competing for the grand prize of $100,000. So it was a game, really. We put them through ordeals. I was myself, a former CIA, former FBI, so I'm former Secret Service, and we put them through all these ordeals to see if they have what it takes. So we put them in ice baths, hung them off the edge of a building, you know, normal stuff.
usual daily stuff in the Secret Service. Is it like a Navy? To me, it sounds like Navy SEAL training.
You know, if I say it, all the Navy SEALs will come after me, so I can't because I never went through SEAL training. Right. However, ours was pretty intense. It was really about putting people in stressful situations and seeing if they could manage their panic. Can you think when you're under stress? Can you problem solve? Or do you completely lose it? And so we put them, it's about physical resilience, and it's also about mental resilience. So every competition, every mission that we gave them, we called them missions, was about testing that and seeing their performance.
Did people?
And then me critiquing it.
I would hate to be in that hot seat. Did people surprise you, or they come out about the way you expected?
You know, I think it wasn't about skill. It was about heart with the with what we put them through. I was more impressed with people that did well. And we had someone who was an ex-felon, and she performed greatly. I think I can't remember if she was in prison or she was in jail, and she was one of my top performers, and she had so much heart, and she kind of looked at it as a way to redeem herself. And I really, wow, I loved it. I empathized with that. So it was for me, it was about passion. Look, you can teach people skills, you can teach them certain things, but if they don't have heart, they don't have passion, it doesn't matter.
I get what you mean. Let me give you guys a little bit of Evie's background. Former Secret Service, as she said, part of the details for President Obama, First Lady Michelle Obama, former presidents George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush, and she was also an interrogator for the agency's elite polygraph unit. And, you know, Evie very kindly supported my HLN show for many years, and we would always go to her for what did we use you for? It felt like it was always like, you know, what's really going on?
Everything.
Yeah.
It was always crime, right?
Yeah.
You would look at people from the clinical perspective as to why they did what they did. And I would look at it from the law enforcement criminal perspective, why they did what they did. And so sometimes we would even clash.
Right, right. Because I don't deal with criminals, right? I mean, it's kind of a different mindset in a weird way. Criminals, I deal with people that behave criminally because they get themselves into a terrible mental health problem, and or people that are motivated to be criminal because of some horrible traumas and that kind of thing. But some people are just criminal. And those people are confusing to me. I know I've been around them before, because usually what they'll do is they'll just sort of, I'll make progress with them, and no matter what, it all just unravels all of a sudden. They sort of have this attitude that everything's bullshit. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it's a cynical perspective.
I think it's
a cynical perspective. Now, if you ever come across people like that, do they also have a substance abuse or addiction issue together? Do you see that, Dr.
Oh, sure. But they're usually, if they have that really cynical, that crazy cynical perspective that I have trouble like getting my head around, like it's so cynical. Usually the substance is part of many pathologies. It's just one of their things they're doing.
So there's like, sometimes you think there's maybe a mental health issue underneath that, and then they take the substance to compensate, or you think sometimes it's
almost
character?
Like, it's almost like, because everything is bullshit, if I feel bad, why shouldn't I take this opiate? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like what matters? Nothing matters. So if I feel bad, this makes me feel better. Screw you. I'm going to do that.
I also think sometimes there's a little bit of that victim mentality too that goes along with it.
I think it can get in there. And I actually think those people are treatable, believe it or not, because that usually means they were victimized, and they can come to get some insight about that and how they're sort of recreating the victimization. So to me, that's a manageable situation. Well, let's talk about the book. Okay. What's going on in becoming bulletproof, and how can I be bulletproof? I don't feel bulletproof these days.
You're probably one of the most resilient people I know working in television all these years. I've learned it's almost as tough a career as being a former Secret Service agent, I have to tell you.
Yeah, I know.
And you really have to have thick skin in this industry. So
I know.
Believe me. Lasting it all these years.
And it's gotten way worse with the advent of social media. And as Adam always points out, I have a delicate constitution. He always gives me crap about that. But I've certainly gotten used to a new normal, which is not a pleasant place, but yeah, you can, you're in here, and you just have to absorb the bullets. I don't know about being bulletproof. You just kind of have to absorb them.
I think, but you also have to think about like where it's coming from. I always call it keyboard courage. It's people are very courageous behind a keyboard and behind, you know, the scenes when they're anonymous. And when you have somebody face to face, it's a whole other ball game.
Yeah. Now, you always were on me about safety. And I still haven't removed some of the positioning data that you'd like me to remove from some of my stuff.
I remember I had gone through your cell phone. So I go through your cell phone, Dr. Drew's cell phone, and I went through all your photos and I was looking at the metadata in your photo.
Yes.
And I was erasing everything. I put an app on your phone.
Oh, no. Wait a minute.
Worried about you.
Hold on.
Because people had such access to you. You know, you're a well-known person. And my concern was always your safety. And I felt like almost like, although I was on your show, I felt like you were my protectee and I felt so responsible for you.
And let me tell you, Evie does not, when you're one of her protectees, she does not approach you with that same delightful smile and good
no.
Spirit. She's like, what are you doing?
What is
going on here? What is this?
What are you thinking? I remember. Well, you know, going back to what you were asking about becoming bulletproof, I mean, that book is probably, I've been approached to write books before, and mostly people wanted, you know, the tell-alls, tell me about this person, tell me about that person, tell me what they were like behind the scenes. And that was not me, and that was not what I wanted to put out there in the world.
Right.
And my mindset was, if I write something, I want to write something to help people.
Right.
And I thought about all the training I had gone through, the academies. You know, I'd been through the NYPD, the Secret Service that has two academies, Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, Secret Service. Then my interviewing interrogation academy, which was the Polygraph Institute. And so I took all these skills that I learned that really, really helped me over the years, not just in my professional career, but they transferred into my personal life, my new career. And I was like, how can I put this all in a book? And I was really thoughtful. So I wanted to do, my thought was, how do you make somebody truly resilient? How do you make people essentially bulletproof? Because a lot of people were kind of pushing me to call the book Fearless. And I was like, I can't call it that because there's no such thing. It doesn't exist. And I don't want to create this myth that people cannot attain, because then people think, oh, I'm afraid something's wrong with me. It's like, there is nothing wrong with you. It is normal to be afraid. We are all afraid. Every time I did a search warrant or arrest warrant, or I went out there with my bulletproof vest, like, there is a sense of fear, like, hey, I could not go home today. Something could happen to me. And that is normal. And so I wanted it to be called Bulletproof and Becoming Bulletproof, because I feel like we're always becoming. And I'm still becoming. We're becoming strong. We're becoming resilient. And I thought about the three different worlds that I could combine to make this unique. So the first part of the section, the book, I wrote it into three parts. The first part was protection, which you and I were just speaking about. How do you physically protect yourself? And then also mentally. Because mental, you know, resilience, the things that people say, they do, the bullying, the hurtfulness, you want to protect against that. So I put everything related to protection, the strategies and techniques we use, that I use to protect the people that I was assigned to, presidents, first ladies, the children of my protectees. The second part I made into reading people, which is just, how do you assess people? And you do this with your practice. How, you know, when you deal with people who are constantly lying to you all the time, how do you read through? How do you read through that? So I did body language, verbal language, assessing verbal language, paralinguistics, like the way people speak, how to assess that. And then the third part was influence strategies. So when we're speaking to people, part of the hurdle that I used to have to overcome when I was an interviewer, an interrogator, was that I had to sway people to talk to me. I had to sway people to tell me the truth. And so there's certain techniques and strategies you use. You can't make people do anything, but you can cultivate a relationship, create a connection with them. And there's certain tools like mirroring, adaptability, reciprocity, all these techniques that you can use or anybody can use in their day-to-day lives. And the idea was that I created a manual that anybody could use to help themselves feel stronger, more resilient, more confident, and all those things essentially make you bulletproof. But also, Dr. Drew, what was important for me is for people to know thyself, to understand themselves, to know their weaknesses, not to just give you a bunch of, I don't want to give fake support to people. It's like, you need to look at yourself, because the only way we can get better is to know where our weaknesses are.
How do you assess that? What was your recommendation for assessing that?
Self-assessment.
Is there a tool in there?
When you're in a situation like what we were just talking about with criminal behavior and people, it's like, do you look externally and blame other people and things for everything that is happening to you? Are you a person who is at the mercy of everything around them? Or do you alter that perception and think, what did I do to cause the situation? Or what could I have done differently to prevent it? And to look for the choices that you can make rather than feeling like, hey, I'm just stuck here. And a big part of the book is self-assessment and being okay with that. And not a lot of people want to look inward and look at like, hey, where am I falling short and where can I do better? It's nice to blame everybody else.
Well, but a lot of people want to do that, but they don't have the ability to do it, or it's a hard thing to do. We all have our cognitive distortions and we all have our biases. How do we get past all that? Is there a kind of an instrument we can use? Or do you have something in the book that's specific?
I talk about different processes of basically, if you're presented a problem and looking at the solution, looking at ways to find solutions where you look through it through a third person assessment. What advice would you give someone else who had this problem? Because when we are in a problem, and I've dealt with this myself, when you're too close to something, we become very emotional and we can't see clearly. So if you look at situations where if you gave me a problem, I would give you advice and you'd be like, oh, wow, it's always easy to solve somebody else's problem rather than your own.
Right.
And so I give tools and strategies that help you step away from the emotional part using time as a disruptor. So basically, when we're in a problem, giving ourselves distance so that we can see better. Think about like maybe emails or texts or moments where you respond to someone, you think, you know what, I shouldn't have done that. I should have waited.
So very similar to what is it Woodrow Wilson? Somebody like that some great president said that never, never make a decision today that you can put off for tomorrow. In other words,
I advocate waiting. Like when you're angry and emotional, like when I'm angry and emotional, I don't text, I don't tweet, I don't call, I don't nothing.
That seems very smart to me. Seems very smart. I'm sorry, I'm getting patience. It is one of these days when I'm getting inundated with things. And, you know, here's part of the problem is everybody that has an upper respiratory infection or pneumonia, you worry like hell they have COVID. And so I'm getting the usual pneumonias and fevers and things I'm seeing this time of year, but the meaning is more intense because everyone hangs on when's my SARS test coming back. So, okay, I want to hear more about the resiliency and about the early parts of your book. But let's go back now around and give me some highlights, because I can't wait to read this book. This sounds so pragmatic and so useful for really everybody. And I'm hungry for this kind of information that you seem to have in this book, particularly these days. So here we are. We're all being stressed, let's say. I mean, this is a very stressful time for literally everybody. Are there things in the book we can find that help us deal with the stress of the current situation? And then I want you to also talk about the resiliency and how people can build that.
So with the current situation, there is a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear. And it's okay to have fear because fear keeps us home, right? Fear helps us social distance. And fear helps us do all those positive things. But it's resiliency is also being aware of what you allow in. So if I'm constantly watching the news 24 hours a day and all I'm watching is COVID, 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 I'm going to create more fear and more panic. So part of that is creating a filter system, being a gatekeeper as to what you consume. And so, for example, this, you should be going, watching the news, getting the information you need. And then at some point, you just got to stop. And then also right before bed, don't consume negative news because you want to prime yourself to sleep well. You want to prime yourself to relax. But if you're watching news and you're on this constant cycle, fear, 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 more fear, and that's what turns into panic. And I would say, what are you consuming and what are you absorbing around you?
And I would say just the term negative news is repetitive. All news is negative right now. And it's seemingly always these days. That's sort of how their business model.
They're not going to put out stuff that's positive. And I know I was a contributor at CNN and HLN. And the only time I'd get called to go on air was when it was something negatives.
Yeah.
We talk about the bad stuff.
Yeah. And yet that feels like the good old days compared to how it is now. Right. I mean, okay.
But being thoughtful, not letting those things in. And then you can also create meaning and find meaning. Like, this is a difficult situation, but what can you control? What can you do? And so there's small things that you can do, whether it's checking on your neighbor, calling loved ones, shopping for someone else. All those things give you power back and you feel that you're contributing and that you're not helpless. It's not like what's being done to me. It's like, what can I do in this environment so that I can feel in control?
So Gary texted me to remind me that it was Harry Truman that said, never make a decision today that you can put off for tomorrow for the very reasons you were suggesting. A friend of mine wrote a book called Fearvana, Ashke and Nanavati. He really advocates leaning into fear. Where are you in that sort of idea?
I'm with your friend. Yeah. I actually have a section in the book. It's called Kill Fear While It's Still Small. Hmm. You know, because it's like a seed. You plant it, and if you leave it and you ignore it, it grows, it grows, it grows, and it expands. And then we can't control it. It becomes like, you know, it becomes an inferno that we can't put out. I feel like when you're afraid of something, embrace it. And create ways in which you can be exposed to fear in small amounts. And then you can increase those amounts. You can expose it. Let's say you're afraid of flying. Maybe drive by an airport. Don't go get on a plane. Drive by an airport. Next time, go sit at the airport lounge. Have something to eat. Expose yourself to environments that make you uncomfortable. Being uncomfortable is okay. And I think, Dr. Drew, we're in this world where it's like everything should be easy, stress-free. We don't want to feel any anxiety or anxiousness. But when we create this cocoon, and this is for parents too, when we do this, then something serious or bad happens, like we're dealing with something now, people don't know how to manage it.
No, we're doing the exact opposite of what you're supposed to do. What you're advocating is called exposure therapy. And that absolutely is how you deal with phobias and obsessions and those sorts of things.
And we've created a world where if somebody feels threatened, well, they've got to avoid any hint of that, as opposed to leaning in, listening, dealing with, managing, which is what gets it, makes it better. So I'm delighted to hear you advocating that kind of thing. Was this all stuff taught at the academies?
You know, it's funny because you use, what was the term you just used? Exposure therapy, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, in training, there's a term, the term behind it was hormetic effect, where you introduce small amounts of stress to someone, they overcome that stress, and then you give them more stress, they overcome that, you give them more stress, they overcome that. And that's how you get a version of one person when they first come into training. They're green, they don't know, they've not dealt with this stuff. And then by the end of training, you have this resilient, strong human being. It's not because, yes, the person does matter to some degree, but it's because of this exposure to stress, this exposure to failure. They would design missions, they would design assignments where you would fail. Like, they didn't want you to succeed because they wanted to see who you were when you were stressed out, who you were when everything around you was falling apart. Could you compose yourself? And it's known as the hermetic effect.
And let's say, you know, we're faced with those kinds of things today and we haven't had the gradual exposure. Are there techniques that people can do to keep it together?
I think it's one of the things you can do is expose yourself to things that make you uncomfortable. So, for example, I'm an adjunct professor. I teach criminal justice criminology. And I have students sometimes, I make them do oral presentations. I had this one student, she had to get up in front of the class to do an oral presentation. She's like, I can't do it. I'm terrified of public speaking. And one of the things I wanted to do with her is work with her to gradually overcome that, because she had built it up into this thing. And so I suggested, why don't you get up and public speak in front of me and just one other student? Let's start in this small way. Expose yourself or take an acting class. Acting classes are great. Get yourself in front of other people. So that way, when you're getting up there to do a presentation for work, or you're doing something really important, or you're giving a big speech to someone, that you're not stressed. You give yourself practice. Or if you're going to go interview for a job and you're really nervous and you're terrible at interviewing, go interview for jobs that you don't want. Put in for a whole bunch of jobs that you don't care that you get and practice. It's exposure. The more you do, the more you experience, the less of a shock it's going to be to you.
Yeah, I've advocated something similar for social phobias. If people have trouble functioning socially, just go out and find ways to incrementally expose yourself. Same things with dating. Just, you know, find ways to hang with people that aren't so threatening. You know, whatever it is, just small. First you get coffee, then you have a phone call. Whatever it is, you just do it slowly and step yourself through it into increasingly stressful circumstances.
Do you feel that dating now is harder for people, for younger people, than it was for maybe our generation?
For the very reason we're talking about here, because they don't have, I have always thought about it as they don't get exposed to the usual developmental milestones, but there might be something even simpler. They just don't get exposed to it. They're busy hanging out or, you know, using online. They don't ever date. They don't understand how to assess themselves and how to hang out with, you know, how to spend time with somebody and how to know how to take it further. They don't have any experience with it. And so what we tend to see is people in their mid-20s suddenly getting obsessed with somebody and then stalking them because they don't know how to navigate when it doesn't work out. Isn't that crazy?
That's interesting.
See how that could happen, right?
Because you've not had experience, you've not had relationships with other people, you don't know what it's like to be rejection.
Right.
Rejection is good. Failure is good. I mean, I talk about it even in my book, because I don't want to just say, hey, look at all the successes I've had. I tried to bring up my failures and my obstacles, because that's just how it is. And we can sit there, and you and I kind of are the same mind. It's like you can sit there and be a victim of it, or you can just overcome it. And you know what? So you get rejected. So what?
Well, here's what this was back in the Mike Catherwood days of Loveline. We get these calls and people would, a guy would call and go, you know, I met the girl, I'm 25 now. And, you know, I met her when I was 23 and we dated a couple times and she wasn't that into it then. She wasn't really ready for a relationship. So I've been waxing her car and walking her dog and shampooing her carpet every week. And it's been 2 years and now it's time. And I'm like, what, time for what? It's like, that's full on stalking behavior. And most young women have no of a relationship like that in their life. and they need to address it. I know the women don't understand that's what's happening. The men don't understand it either. They think they're, you know, just waiting it out until she's ready to have that relationship that she wasn't ready for when you were 23, as opposed to that's rejection. That's rejection. Move on. They don't know how to do that.
It's okay to be rejected.
Yeah.
Like, who hasn't been
rejected? Good, not okay. It's good. It's good. Yeah, right. It's good. We've all been rejected. It's A-okay. It's how we get where we are. Okay, so that's the first part of the book. The second part is?
Reading people. My favorite part, yeah, body language.
Tell me about this.
So, because what people say and what they actually mean is not always in harmony, and you know that, people lie quite a bit. And there's, Dr. Drew, there's three predominant ways people lie. Somebody will tell a lie that's completely manufactured from beginning to end. It's just a complete lie. Or they'll tell you a little bit of truth, a little bit of lie, a little bit of truth, a little bit of lie. So they mix it up. But the primary way people lie is by omission. They just leave it out. Because for the most part, most people know I shouldn't lie. It's not right. And so the way we kind of get around it is we leave it out. So that's the part where people get tripped up. How do I assess someone? How do I read someone? And because we're always on our devices, and because we're such an egocentric population, we're always thinking about ourselves, me, me, me. I kind of flip it. And I tell people, I want you to focus on the person across from you, assessing their body language, because it's not just what people say. It's, I want you to, like, I tell people, open up your eyes and listen. Take people in, absorb them, watch what they're doing with their body, listen to what they're saying. Some research says over 70% of what we communicate is with our bodies. Mm-hmm. And so we can miss so much. But then also feeling people. You can feel people, whether there's their energy, their vibe, whatever it is. So take people in and assess them. And then I talk about assessing language, listening to the words people use. There's certain things that we do, like stalling tactics or things people say. So for example, like, let's say I give you a call and I'm like, hey, Dr. Drew, what's going on? How's your family? All that. Okay, great. And then right before we're going to get off the call, I'm going to say, oh, hey, by the way.
Right.
When you hear that, that translation typically means that's really why I called you.
Right.
That is essentially why I called you. And so there's certain techniques like that. Or when somebody says, hey, trust me. I usually tell people when you hear somebody says, hey, trust me, go the other way. And so I kind of help walk people through the red flags of behavior. Now, and I want to make it clear too to people, because there's a lot of other individuals out there or entities out there that sell techniques like, if somebody does this, they're a liar.
Right.
And that's not true, because we're all unique. We're biologically different. The way we're raised, our parents, our culture, our socioeconomic background, our education, all these things affect who we are, how we process information and how we see the world and how we're going to behave. So there is no one way to tell somebody's lying. But when we look at people, when we know when to spot those red flags, we can say, okay, this person just said this. Or this person just, when I asked them, what'd you do last night? All of a sudden the arms crossed and they leaned back. Why did they do that? So rather than becoming accusatory, we want to ask the question. We want to become curious. And then you know what following questions to ask. And we're looking for clusters of behavior, things that change in human behavior, and assess that. And then also thinking about flipping it around on people, because the way you try to size everybody up, people try to size you up. So being aware of your behavior, how you carry yourself, how other people read you, all those things are super important. So that's the second part. I think it's the part people.
How do you assess that? That's a harder part to assess, right?
Which part?
How other people perceive you, yeah.
Do you know, when I started going on television and I started looking at my posture and the way I walked into a room and all these different things, it's seeing yourself. How do other people see you? So having a moment, like I have a bracelet that somebody gave me, it says posture check. And from time to time, I look down and I'm like, oh, I'm slouching. Or when I do the show, when we do your show and sometimes I start slouching, my husband who was watching, he'd send me a text like, sit up, you're slouching. And something as small as that, because I'm slouching or not seated properly, the viewer's going to look and be like, she doesn't know herself. She's not confident.
Yeah.
She doesn't. So it's really, think about when you walk into a room, how are you walking into that room? Is your chin parallel to the floor? What's your body doing? But we get lost in everything else and we don't stop. And it's just a constant self-assessment. And every day it's different. Today it's like, I'm just going to work on chin up, chin up. off my phone? Oh, are my shoulders back? How am I seated? When someone's talking to me, am I nodding my head and showing that I'm really listening to them? Or do I look distracted? Am I on my phone? All these different things help you become a better communicator. There's no gimmick. There's no, hey, you do this, these three things. I'm going to give you a checklist. You do these three things.
Right.
You're golden. It's work. Well, and it's creating positive habits.
I am truly excited to welcome Theragun. I am telling you something. I've been using their products and I love them. You will too. Listen, it's a handheld, we call a handheld percussive therapy device. You guys have seen these sorts of things, but Theragun have brought it to a level. They've perfected it. They have scientifically calibrated combination of depth, speed, and power, and now it's quiet. My dog freaks out when I bring out one of these devices, and since I've switched to Theragun, he sits there while I get the therapy I need. The all-new Gen 4 Theragun has proprietary brushless motor. It is so quiet, you even wonder if it's on. And you can try Theragun risk-free for 30 days. There is no substitute for Theragun Gen 4 with an OLED screen, personalized Theragun app, and quiet and power you need. The app is fantastic. I have it myself, and I use it on my, I've got a terrible shoulder. I use it on my shoulder, my neck. I had a hip thing that was ridiculous while I was trying to run during the quarantine, and then I just used the Theragun on there, took care of it. I am telling you, I am so happy with this product. Starts at only $199. Go to Theragun.com/Drew right now and get your Gen 4 Theragun today. That's Theragun, Theragun.com/Drew. Again, Theragun.com/Drew. You will be as excited as I am when you see this thing. It truly helps. Get Theragun.com/Drew. And now back to the show.
And I want to go back to an issue you raised there that is something that is a skill, and it's very difficult for many people to develop. And you talked about listen, but also take the person in. You said that was the language you use. Clinically, what we say is, how does that person? What feelings are you? Is what's happening in your body because of that person? So you said listen with your eyes, which is really part of that. But I always say, listen with your whole body, like your body's an antenna. And if you start feeling things in your body, listen to that as well as listening to the words of what the person is saying. It's very difficult to do. And if you hear music or feel things in your chest or whatever, just, you know, that it's meaningful. You may not know what it means yet. Make note of it. Do you have those sorts of experiences?
Yes, I believe in that. You have to absorb people, like be like a sponge. And yeah. I talk about it, use all your senses to take people in. Mm. It's kind of like when you walk into a room and there's that one person and you know they're angry. They haven't said anything. They didn't do anything, but you can feel that energy. That you should listen to that.
But how do you get to, so it's hard to hear that little voice in your head that's, you know, reacting in whatever way it's reacting. And then how do you give any tips on how to interpret it? Or is it just something you got to practice?
One is practice and self-assessment, just being aware that, hey, am I doing this? Because that's the number one thing. Nobody thinks about, I need to do this. We get lost and we forget. So just bringing awareness back to yourself. The other thing is being quiet. So that means less talking, less interacting, active listening, which is absorbing people like we're talking about. And when you active listen, it's taking people in using all your senses. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That means you're not on your phone. That means you're not holding your phone. That means your phone's away. And it's being able to be quiet with yourself, and meditation is a great tool for that.
Are you consciously doing anything with your face when you are listening like that? Are you reflecting, or is it just something that happens automatically? Or are you doing something consciously?
It depends. Well, it depends what my goal is. Usually if I just want to listen to someone, I make sure I maintain good eye contact. You don't want to give them that crazy death stare, but you do want to maintain good eye contact, especially if you're the speaker. Now, if somebody is listening to you, it's okay for them to break eye contact. Some research shows that people will break eye contact up to 40% of the time, and that's normal. Mm-hmm. Like, it's normal for people's eyes to go where. But when you are the speaker and you want to impress an idea or something on someone, you should maintain greater eye contact with the person. Now, with your expression, depends what you're after. If you want information from someone, you don't want to come off as if you're judging them. So if somebody tells you something that you don't agree with, but you want to maintain a good connection with them, don't roll your eyes. Don't make faces. I call it the poker face. Put on your poker face.
Well, is it a flat face? Because flat faces people get uncomfortable with too. So I'm guessing you reflect a little bit of emotion back, just signaling appreciation of what they're saying.
Yes, appreciation, yeah. Leaning in, head nodding, connecting with people. You want to find the most authentic version of you to connect with that person. Yeah. If you care, if you can bring yourself to a point where you care about what the person's saying, your expression will happen on its own. Sometimes maybe a slight smile, but definitely nothing that's going to shut that person down. Right. Now, mirroring, you kind of talked about mimicking or kind of looking at other people's behavior and seeing what they do versus like what you should do. There's something called mirroring, and that comes up. I actually talk about this in the influence section of the book, where if you have someone, maybe Dr. Drew, you're dealing with a patient and they're disconnected. So they're back, they're leaning back, they're crossed off, they're closed off from you. You want to connect with them. Now, you don't want to mirror their body language because it's a negative body language. But what you
can do... Say that again. Say that again. Why is that a negative?
Because if their arms are crossed, if they have negative body language...
I see.
You don't want to mirror.
Don't mirror negative.
Works in certain ways.
Got it.
So if I have someone, you have a patient, they're closed off, they're leaning back. Right? We want to get them to open up to you. So what you're going to do is you're going to lean in. You're going to have openness. So what we want to do is always kind of hands out, palms out, empty hands. That shows like, hey, I'm open. I'm here. I'm connecting with you. You want to be frontally aligned with the person. And that creates the connection. Now, slowly, as you connect with them, as that trust and that rapport, it's really rapport that begins first. Eventually, you're going to see them open up and reflect your body language. They're going to mirror you. And so that, as the body does that, the mind's going to follow and it creates a sense of openness. Now, in other situations,
I'm going to let you go on with that in a second, but it just reminds me of a body language I see all the time that I never hear anybody talk about. I don't remember if I ever brought this up to you, but I've noticed males particularly, when there's another male that they want to signal authority, not their authority. They want to signal the other person's authority, but a resistance to whatever they have to offer. In other words, it's signaling, you're the bigger fish, but I ain't going to do what you're, they'll do this. They'll put their hands behind their neck and lean back. Have you seen that? I've seen chimpanzees do it too. It's the strangest behavior. And it's such a big movement. You would think we'd be aware of it and always a leaning back with it too.
You'll see that and you'll see this.
Yeah. Well, that one seems a little more, I don't know what, but this one is such a big movement and it's so, and nobody seems to notice it.
I
noticed when I'm in the room, Gary, you there?
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt, but why don't you go ahead and verbally describe what it is you're doing? You guys can see each other, but for the listener,
I am leaning back in my chair. I'm clasping my hands behind my neck and letting my elbows sort of extend out to the side. Like Gary, how would you describe this?
It's kind of how someone would be stretching or wanting to appear as though they are relaxing and listening, but in reality, it looks somewhat pompous.
It's what people do when they lie down and put their hands behind their neck and go, I'm resting now. You know, it's this kind of feel, but they're upright.
Correct.
They're not lying back.
And the other one you guys were mimicking was sort of if you were to be driving and you were to put your arm on the seat next to you, sort of arm up on the shoulder of the person next to you or something
like that. Right, sort of a sideways kind of, all right.
Correct.
But go ahead, Abby, tell us.
I would see that too. I totally agree with you. And that when you see that behavior, and it's usually somebody telling you with their body language, you're not the boss of me.
Yeah, it's true. But I've never seen anybody do that with the hands behind the neck and become firm or aggressive. They're always very friendly and acknowledging the other person's authority, but then it doesn't go anywhere. I've been in rooms with extremely important people let's say the head of a network and the head of a production company. And the head of the production company is like, oh my God, I love you. You know, you're the head of the network. I have such respect for you. And then lean back and do this. And I thought, oh, meeting's over. It's like, whatever we came in here for, we're not going to get.
You know, that's right. It's a huge red flag. And they're also extending their power. If you think about it, they're trying to take space. Insecure people close in, they contract.
Yeah.
And people who want to like show and kind of show their power, they'll spread out. They'll take up as much room. They'll spread their legs. They'll spread their elbows. you know, the position kind of like we're talking about actually reminds me of the sit-up position right before you're about to do a sit-up, how you put
there
your
you
hands
that, that's
behind
it.
Your
that's
neck.
It. That's
you lean
it.
Back like, yo, what's up? I'm in charge. I'm the boss. And so, yes.
It also reminds me of what
power pugs.
It also reminds me of what President Trump does all the time. He, without exception, I don't know if he knows he's doing this. He sits when he's with another world leader. He sits forward, lean forward on the seat with his legs way apart and his hands in front of him like a diamond. Like, let me show you. Like a diamond situation.
A temple, like they do the temple with their hands.
But right over his genitals. Just over his genitals. They always puts the hands right over his genital and just sits there like that. And nobody comments ever. I think it's extraordinary. Gary, pull up a picture if you can of him doing that. Whenever he's with a world leader, that's how he sits. And I think humans are the strangest animals, but it means something, I guess.
It's the steepling of the hands. You'll see this a lot. People do it in front of their face. I guess he just tends to do it by his legs over there. Again, it's another power thing that you'll see people do. They tell you if you're communicating with someone and you want to connect with them, it's something you really shouldn't do. But you'll see a lot of powerful people. And I think there's just a myth out there that people think if you do this, and I've been asked this, oh, should I steeple my hands? Is that a power pose? It's not an anything pose. It just blocks you from the other person. You kind of look silly when you do it.
I know I do it. I tell you what, I like I'm sitting right now. There's President Trump. You see it? Can you see it, Evie?
I see it.
That's how he sits every time he's with a world. Oh, the other guy's doing it too, though.
The other guy's doing it. That's what I was looking at.
Yeah, the other guy has a version of it, a little more phallic version of it. I gotta say,
a little smaller.
It's smaller too. It's a smaller.
Smaller.
Oh my god, that's so weird. But I know I will sit like this and signal I'm thinking and listening, and but I'm anxious. This will signal I'm steepling my hands in front of my mouth. And so covering your mouth has a lot of meaning too, right? It sort of means shame and embarrassment and all these things.
For some folks, and again, we want to be careful because just because somebody does it doesn't mean that this is happening. You see these behaviors, you note them, you get curious, right?
Yeah.
You ask the follow-up questions. But usually when people are about to tell you a lie or if you ask them a question, they don't want to answer it. Even if they answer truthfully, you may see hands go in front of the mouth or you'll see this. Sometimes. Now, if you're always sitting this way, that just means that's how you're sitting. That's how
this
you're thinking.
This way is like a prayer. Prayer.
But if the whole time you're speaking with someone, and then you ask them a question about whether, you know, if it's substance abuse, right? It's like, hey, you know, have you recently done X, Y, and Z? And all of a sudden the hands go in front of the face the hands go in front of the face. That's a signal to you that, you know what, they're not comfortable with what they're going to say. So either they don't want to answer the question or it's possible they might lie to you when they answer this question.
Right. So I'm imagining you're a drug addict when you were saying that. And I thought to myself, well, the hand to the mouth, I would immediately go, well, they're embarrassed. I would make them feel better, not have to be embarrassed, relax. The hands in front of the face like that, as they start to answer a drug addict, I would go, whatever comes next is bullshit. I know for sure. So that's interesting. Yeah, I automatically have those sorts of biases in my head when managing, you know, having been in these situations millions of times with drugs.
But I think it's because you've seen this behavior over and over and over again, so you know what you're looking for. So you're looking, it becomes habit for you. These are the tells that you see when you deal with people.
It does, but I'm not sure I would have been able to explain it to you cognitively without seeing it and experiencing it going, oh yeah, that's how I feel when somebody does that. So it's interesting. Like it's like the more primitive parts of the brain, the thinking fast, thinking slow stuff, and the thinking fast part of the brain, the more emotional centers. I have lots of information comes to me when I'm looking at a patient.
Yeah, when I would interview people, possible suspects or even victims, and when I'd ask them a question about the crime or situation, I'd see the hand go a lot of times in front of the mouth, and it's almost like people are trying to stop the words from coming out of their mouth. Like they try to shield themselves.
Interesting. And then, so keep going with the persuasion. So now you're getting into the persuasion stuff, right?
Yeah. That's part three was just influence. How do we influence people? How do we use strategies? And it's not about manipulating people because you can't really make people do anything.
Yeah.
And the important thing with influence that I share with people is you can influence people in the short term, maybe getting them to come to an appointment, go to rehab, but to influence somebody, to change somebody's inherent values, that's very, very different. And so these strategies are not about changing people because people change only if they want to, but it's about the short-term influence, So how do I get this TV deal? How do I get a good agent? How do I, you know, negotiate this business deal? How do I get a date? It's kind of that short-term window. How do we get people to say yes to the things we want, right? Things are hard enough.
Tell us, oh, great one.
There's a bunch of different strategies that I talk about. Mirroring, which is something that we just talked about earlier. People want to feel that they have something in common with the other person. So mirroring, you can do that with people's body language. You can also even do that with food. Sometimes, Dr. Drew, when I come out to LA and I have business meetings with executives or whatever, I look to see what they're ordering. If they're having salad and I'm not a salad person, guess what I get? I get salad. Or if they drink something, I'll drink what they're drinking. It creates a sense of commonness, like a commonality. And that creates rapport, which creates trust. It's kind of like, oh, wow, she's like me or he's like me. It's almost like when somebody has the same birthday as you or they watch the same movie as you and that's their favorite show. And you're like, oh, I love that show. Oh, my God, you have the same birthday as me. Why do we get so excited? We like people who remind us of us. And so there's certain techniques that work. And then adaptability is another one I talk about. Some people can't pivot, your ability to pivot. So you have a narrative in your head. Things are supposed to go this way. And when you're rigid, and rigid people are some of the most dangerous people because they see it this way and they can't see it any other way. Those people struggle with negotiation. They struggle with communication. They just struggle, struggle, struggle. Your ability to see something and pivot and shift and adapt is huge. And so I talk about your ability to adapt to the person across from you. That will make you better at influencing people rather than being stuck on, no, it's supposed to go this way. Accepting what people say, for example, I think a strategy that I've learned to use when I would interview someone, right off the bat, usually people didn't like me because I represented law enforcement. And most folks have a negative view of it. Also, if they're talking to me, there was a chance that I was talking to them about a crime, something that could land them in jail or prison. So right away, there was going to be conflict. There was going to be resistance. And people would come into the room very angry. And I would accept that. Rather than try to change how they were feeling right off the bat, I'd let them go. So I'd let them go for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, just go, rant, rave, say whatever. And then they get it all out. People want to feel understood, so they'd feel understood. They felt that they got it out. They're tired. Now I can speak because I allowed them to speak. Now whatever I say is going to land on them. But if you don't let people express themselves, get angry, let it out without taking it personally, understand that it's what's going on with them, they're not going to hear you because we want to bring people to a place where they hear us. Otherwise, I'm going, that person's going. I'm going, he's going. I'm going, he's going. Let them go. Them get to a place where they're done, and then now you can speak to them and they can actually hear you. So there's all these different strategies that you can use to connect with people better, negotiate with people better. So but it's about understanding the person across from you too. A lot of it's tied into psychology.
Oh yeah, oh yes. You and I are speaking the same language here. But there's a piece, like I have no problem pivoting. In fact, I would say I'm buffeted, you know, too much by what's sitting across from me. So the flip side of what you're describing, I would wonder, how do you set boundaries if you're pivoting too much, if you're getting to see, if you lose your own, let's say you come to an interaction when you have a set of priorities that's different from the person sitting across from you, and you start getting too involved with the other person's point of view. How do you set boundaries?
Sometimes you have to let people go. So for example, it's a really good question because I would go in to interview someone and I had a specific agenda. I want to know if you committed X crime or if you did this, and they would go somewhere else with it. I would allow them to go. It's a lot of it's patience. I would allow them to go for a while. So maybe if you have a patient, your first session with them, you might just let them go that session. You might not really get to the crux of what you want, because what we do is I want to get to the point and that person needs to kind of go here and then here and then here. But by letting them do that, you build rapport.
Yeah.
You got to think long term. You build rapport and they think, you know what, also, that doctor listened to me.
It's also pulling yourself out of the situation and then assessing what just happened too. Because sometimes you'll see it differently when you're outside of the relationship with whoever you're talking to.
Well, how many times have you talked to someone, like a patient or someone, and then you leave and you think back and you think, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Right? I missed that. Or wait a minute. He said this or she said that.
Yeah. or I got completely sucked into something or whatever. It is, you'll just go, oh, not again. You know, it's that kind of thing. Yeah,
I need to sit in on your interviews. I got to sit in on your patient interviews.
Oh, listen, I always try to bring one of my nurses with me, and they'll kick me in the back of the chair when they see me sliding into too far to the patient perspective, which is really easy to do if you're really empathizing with somebody. You're trying to get their point of view. You're trying to get your self in their head.
But I think that's smart because I don't see it as you getting sucked in. I see it as you building rapport. Even Dr. Drew, everything they're telling you is complete BS, right?
Yeah. No, well, it does. It's definitely the right thing to do. But let's say, for instance, I completely validated and accepted everything someone says, as opposed to just hearing it and experiencing it. You know, then they will want to build off. They'll demand more and more and more, and that's all blowing through boundaries all the way across, as opposed to helping them deal with their own stuff, which is putting it back on the patient. See how that works?
Yes.
Sense.
Well, I think what I would do is, because people would sell me BS stories, I would allow them to tell me their story. I would listen quietly. And then when they were done, I would speak.
Yeah.
And I would call out or question. I'm like, hey, earlier on you said this. Can you explain this? Because, you know, I have something else, or what it seems to me. And sometimes people will give you resistance. And one of the techniques I would use is say, hey, you know what? For 30 minutes, I gave you the respect and I listened to you. I just want to get through these points. You would just extend to me the same courtesy that I extended to you. You don't have to agree with me, but just let me kind of like express these things and lay them out.
Give me a couple more. What it seems to me, because we always use the I'm wondering, or I wonder if you would, what are the sort of the phrases you use to not be confrontative?
All right. So we never want to tell somebody, hey, you're a liar. Number one.
Yeah.
One of the good verbiage to use is like, you know what? I could tell that, you know, there's something seems to be missing here, or, you know, I'm not sure if you're telling me everything.
I wonder if you can help me. I'm missing something. I mean, please help me. Right.
Please help me. I'm missing something. You know, I don't know if you're being, you know, there's some truthfulness here, and I want to have an open conversation. You know, you can prime people. Hi, how are you? I'm Dr. Drew. You know, I'm so glad you're here. I want us to have an open and honest relationship and work together so that we can get you to where you're feeling good. You know, I want to take care of you. And so you can throw priming words like open, cooperate, sharing. Sprinkle those words in into your introduction. You prime people to be open, cooperative, sharing, in agreement. Those are priming words. So we prime people to be in a positive mindset so that they can connect with us.
Fantastic.
And you know what else is really good for language? If you want someone to tell you something and they're kind of closed off, there's an acronym that I was taught, not mine. It's called TED, T-E-D. Tell me, you know, your experience. Explain to me what happened to you. Describe to me what you're feeling. TED is really great because it allows you to ask open-ended questions, and it allows that person to tell you a story, because we get more information from people when they tell us a story versus if they answer closed-ended questions.
Great. I love that. Tell me, explain, describe. Perfect. Those are the stuff. That's what I was looking for.
That's interrogation 101 from the intelligence
community. I love it. And it's communication 101 because people don't know how to communicate, especially these days.
No.
Well, Evie, tell me before we wrap up about the Dunkin' Donuts and first responders.
So we're in this situation here, and yeah. You know, I really thought about what can I do to help. It's just, this is tragedy. I know so many people who are ill and sick, and I was thinking, what can I do to contribute? Is there a way to do it? And there's so many different ways to do it. So I thought about our law enforcement and first responders. A lot of them are working around their clock. They're not getting food. They're not getting breaks. So I reached out to Dunkin', which I'm a huge donuts person. Let me just put it out there. And I said, look, do you guys want to partner up so that we can help feed our first responders?
Right.
And they were all in. And so what we've been doing is going to hospitals, going to police departments, and just showing up with coffee and donuts.
Oh my God.
And just saying, here you go. Thank you. Tomorrow, we're going to the NYPD. We're going to the Bronx. We're going to hit some of the precincts there. And these small acts of kindness, they do wonders. I remember Dr. Drew, and you and I talked about it back when we used to do the show. You know, I was a survivor and first responder from 9/11. And I remember McDonald's. When I was sifting through and helping with the recovery efforts, the rescue efforts. McDonald's was coming around and they were literally had a cart and they were handing out burgers and McNuggets and everything. And I remember that, something as simple as that. And I remember thinking, wow, thank you, because I didn't have time to get up and break away and go get food. They would bring it to me and it stayed with me. Mm. And so even though I'm no longer a first responder, my thought was, what can I do to contribute? So you could look at it like, is it just donuts or is it, it's something more? And I've had people reach out, hey, can you come to my hospital? Hey, can you come visit us? And I think people just want to feel like the support, the love.
Yeah.
They just want to feel like people are appreciative of them. And I mean, honestly, who doesn't love donuts?
And please let me know if I can help you with that, because I'm trying to contribute wherever I can. This sounds like a very worthy operation. So please let me know what I can do.
Absolutely. Even Health Aid jumped on board. You know, are you familiar with kombucha? I don't know if you drink it.
I'm familiar with it.
So Health Aid contributed kombucha as well, because they want to give it to the first responders. It's probiotic. It helps with immune systems, to strengthen the immune system. So we're even passing those out. So absolutely, we will definitely connect on that.
Well, I can't wait to read the book, Becoming Bulletproof, Protect Yourself, Read People, Influence Situations, and Live Fearlessly. It seems like you get it, guys, get a hint that you'll get all of that if you read the book. EvyPompouras.com, Evy spelled E-V-Y, Pompouras, P-O-U-M-P-O-R-A-S, and Twitter and Instagram at Evy Pompouras. Evy, it is, as always, a pleasure and great to see you.
It's always great to see you, Dr. Drew. Take care, okay?
Thanks. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, Drew.
For calling times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.